So think about this. In 2025, Europe had what was, I mean, arguably the most sophisticated, highly funded, legally integrated water monitoring system in human history.
Oh, absolutely. The scale was massive.
Right. Like they were tracking just about every conceivable metric across thousands of river basins. They had the sensors, they had the scientists, the political frameworks. Everything was perfectly aligned to clean up their waterways.
All the tools you could possibly want.
Exactly. And yet, official reporting that year showed that almost 60% of their surface water was still deeply polluted.
Yeah, it's a staggering failure.
It's wild because we've essentially built a civilization that is, incredibly good at diagnosing its own injuries, but somehow structurally incapable of stopping them.
I mean, it is this profound structural paralysis, right? We have the data, we have the scientific consensus,
Yeah.
we even have these highly capable local institutions that are really trying to do the right thing. But when it comes to these massive cross-system problems like ecological collapse or climate change, the machinery of our governance just spins in place.
And that contradiction, that is exactly our mission for today. Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Yeah.
We are looking at a system that fails not because of ignorance, but because of architecture. Today is August 30, 2026, and we are diving deep into a groundbreaking new research manuscript for you today.
It's really a fascinating piece of work.
Yeah, it's by Bechara Saley, titled Institutions of Reflexive Transformation, which, sounds like a mouthful, but it's part of this much larger, rigorously analytical project on what the author terms civilizational healing.
And the premise of this specific manuscript is just incredibly ambitious. It essentially attempts to answer the ultimate puzzle of modern governance, which is how can human beings actually coordinate to fix these massive distributed injuries without accidentally creating a dystopian, all-powerful central authority in the
Right,
process?
because historically,
Right. Our attempts to fix chaos usually end up creating a tyrant.
okay, let's unpack this,
Yeah.
because to understand the solution that's mapped out in this research, we have to look at the trap we just keep falling into. The framework calls this the coordination domination dilemma.
Yes, the coordination domination dilemma.
And it starts with understanding how modern crises actually behave. So let's take extreme heat exposure for you as an example. If a massive heat wave hits a region, our administrative reflex is usually to just treat it as an environmental problem.
Right, but an injury like extreme heat, it doesn't respect the neat little boxes of our organizational charts.
No, not at all.
A heat wave immediately moves through housing infrastructure, right? Which causes lethal indoor temperatures. It impacts agricultural labor, creating severe occupational hazards, threatens the food supply.
The hospitals get overwhelmed.
Exactly. It stresses the health system with mass casualties. And it strains energy grids to the point of collapse, which then, triggers insurance crises. It crosses over all these boundaries simultaneously.
It's just everywhere all at once. And the same goes for river degradation. Like, a dying river isn't just an ecological problem. It's totally entangled with agricultural policy and fertilizer subsidies.
It involves municipal land use zoning.
Yeah, it touches industrial regulation, local finance, even international treaty obligations. The crisis is entirely scattered across the board.
Which means that no single ministry or local court or scientific body can legitimately or competently solve the problem on its own. The relevant knowledge and the capacity to act are distributed across dozens of different institutions.
They're all holding a piece of the puzzle.
Right. So when administrators look at this fragmentation, the immediate overwhelming instinct is to say, well, we need to coordinate.
Which sounds totally innocent. Like, let's all get in a room, share our data, and coordinate a response.
Yeah.
What could possibly go wrong with just getting everyone on the same page?
Well, what goes wrong is that coordination is not an innocent, neutral, technical operation. It is an exercise of massive structural power.
Wow. Okay, explain that.
Whoever gets to convene that room suddenly has the power to set the agenda. They decide which consequences even become visible to the group. The body that standardizes the data gets to privilege certain categories of knowledge and make others administratively disappear.
Oh, right, because they're the ones writing the spreadsheets.
Exactly. And think about the funding. If a massive international body steps in to, coordinate a response to river pollution and they hold the purse strings, they don't even have to issue a direct command to control the outcome.
They just say, we only fund this one thing.
Exactly. They just declare, we will only fund projects that meet this specific narrow metric. And overnight, every local agency twists its entire mission to fit that metric.
That makes so much sense. That is the core tension, then. The mechanism we use to coordinate knowledge and action can very quickly acquire this concentrated epistemic or political power. We try to solve fragmentation, and we accidentally build a new center of domination.
And that right there is the coordination-domination dilemma.
I really want to visualize this for you listening, because the research maps this out brilliantly using a four-quadrant matrix. So imagine a graph. On one axis, you have functional differentiation, which basically means how well we keep different kinds of expertise separated.
Right.
And on the other axis, you have accountable coordination, which is how well those separate pieces actually work together toward a shared goal.
So let's walk through the failure modes first. I think that's the easiest way to see it. If you have low differentiation and low coordination, you're in the bottom left quadrant. This is what the author calls institutional incoherence.
Right. Nobody knows what they're doing.
Exactly. The boundaries of competence are a mess. Nobody knows what their specific job is. And there is no joint action happening anyway.
Complete gridlock. Okay, now let's move to the top left quadrant. High differentiation, but low coordination. The framework calls this polycentric fragmentation.
Yes. Here you have lots of very distinct, highly capable centers. You have specialized water agencies, brilliant local governments, world-class scientific panels, but the consequences and the responsibility remain totally disconnected.
Right.
Knowledge never crosses actionable boundaries.
I feel like this is a super familiar scenario in public policy. Like, everyone can correctly describe the problem, and everyone can eloquently explain why someone else needs to be the one to move first.
Responsibility is widely acknowledged, but it is owned nowhere.
It's like the classic nightmare group project. You know, you have a researcher, a writer, and a designer, and they're all incredibly talented people, but they never talk to each other.
Yeah, perfect analogy.
The researcher investigates the wrong topic, the writer writes an essay that doesn't match the research, and the designer formats it for a poster instead of a slide deck. Everyone did their job perfectly in isolation, but the final project is a complete disaster.
That's exactly it. Now consider the opposite danger. Move down to the bottom right quadrant. Low differentiation, but high coordination. This is monocentric integration.
The tyrant of the group project.
Yep.
The one person who aggressively takes over the entire assignment. They ignore everyone else's good ideas. They do all the work their own way, and they just dictate the final product.
And you get coherent action, certainly. I mean, the project gets turned in on time. But there is a massive risk of epistemic and political overreach. A central office or an executive acquires powers for which they do not actually have the competence or the democratic authorization.
They just bulldoze everything.
They crush dissenting evidence. They ignore local context. They become a locus of domination.
Which leaves us searching for the Holy Grail, the top right quadrant, high differentiation and high accountable coordination. And the framework labels this reflexive, polycentric coordination.
That is the ultimate target. It describes a condition where authority is differentiated, meaning institutions retain their specialized, distinct competence, but they're joined by consequential links.
Okay.
And crucially, the coordination itself remains contestable and anchored in democratic processes.
I think we need to pause right here and address a common misconception. Because when we talk about the dangers of a central authority or a tyrant, it's very easy to just jump to the conclusion that decentralization is always the hero and centralization is always the villain.
Oh, definitely.
But this research explicitly pushes back on that romantic idea of localism, doesn't it?
It pushes back hard. We have to recognize that hierarchy actually belongs in certain situations. Decentralization is not a magic wand. Hierarchy outperforms decentralized networks when tasks are tightly coupled. You know, when a delay would cause catastrophic harm, or when commands must be completely unambiguous.
Right, like if a Category 5 hurricane is bearing down on the coast, you do not want a polycentric network of autonomous local agencies debating the data standards of the rescue helicopters while the water rises.
No, absolutely not.
You want a unified central emergency command structure that can issue orders and move resources instantly.
You need speed and you need unity. And hierarchy is also fundamentally appropriate for enforcing uniform human rights floors.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah, you don't want a system so highly decentralized that a local majority can legally oppress a local minority. Courts need to authoritatively protect rights across the board. Environmental regulators need the hierarchical power to enforce absolute baseline safety floors.
But there is a massive caveat built into this, right? Bounded hierarchy might be necessary, but it has to remain strictly bounded.
Exactly. The mandate must be specific, the function clear, and where relevant, the duration strict. Emergency authority cannot be allowed to silently mutate into permanent constitutional power.
Like, just because a federal agency has a command role during a disaster response doesn't mean it suddenly gets to dictate long-term local economic policy.
Or suppress scientific evidence about climate change. An institutional ecology can contain authoritative centers without becoming completely dominated by them.
So we know we want this top right quadrant. We want institutions to keep their specific expertise but work together without creating a dictator. How do we actually build that?
Well, the research provides a very specific operational grammar to achieve this. It's a two-part mandate. Integrate consequences, differentiate authority.
Integrate consequences, differentiate authority. That short phrase contains an immense amount of architectural theory. Let's break down the first half. Integrate consequences.
So this means creating actual legal and procedural pathways by which evidence or injury claims enter the specific institutions that possess the capacity to act on them. When an injury occurs, the signal cannot just die in a filing cabinet.
And the text highlights a crucial distinction here that absolutely blew my mind. It's the difference between connectivity and interoperability.
This is perhaps one of the most vital insights for understanding why modern governance fails. Connectivity exists when a transmission is merely received.
Okay, give me an example.
Let's say a scientific panel publishes a rigorous, terrifying report on worsening air pollution and sends it to the Ministry of Health. The ministry receives it, they upload it to their website.
Right.
The two institutions are connected.
But that doesn't mean anything actually changes.
Exactly. Interoperability exists only when the receiving institution has the legal and procedural architecture to translate that transmission into a legitimate institutional consequence.
Okay.
If the Ministry of Health gets the air pollution report, but their statutory mandates, their budget rules, or their data classifications prevent them from actually altering their operations based on that evidence, they are connected, but they are not interoperable.
I like to think of this like a household fire alarm. Imagine you have a smoke detector that is perfectly connected to a flashing light in your living room. The smoke detector senses the fire perfectly. The light flashes perfectly. You have total connectivity.
Right.
But it's not interoperable with the sprinkler system. It's not interoperable with the fire department's dispatch. It just flashes a brilliant red light while the entire house burns to the ground.
That is a staggering reality of our current world.
Yeah.
We are drowning in connectivity and starving for interoperability.
What?
We have incredible dashboards, open data portals, and interagency memos. The system has shared data, which vastly improves our description of the problem, but it leaves the actual harm completely untouched because there is no lawful duty to respond.
There's no trigger.
Exactly. There is no named budget authority that automatically triggers when a certain threshold of harm is detected.
Well, wait, let me push back on this a little bit. Because if we demand interoperability across the board, if we require health agencies to interoperate with housing, and agriculture to interoperate with finance, aren't we just building a massive administrative traffic jam?
That's a fair concern.
Like, look at environmental review laws in places like California. They were designed to integrate all these different concerns, you know, environmental, historical, neighborhood impacts. And the result is that it takes a decade to build a single solar farm. How does this framework prevent integration from just becoming total gridlock?
Well, you're pointing to a very real failure mode of poorly designed integration. When integration just means giving everyone a veto over everyone else, you get paralysis. But the research addresses this by distinguishing between mere bureaucratic friction and structured redundancy. Drawing on organizational scholarship, it points out that a governance ecology needs redundant pathways to prevent a single point of failure.
Meaning we don't just want one single agency in charge of catching every problem.
Right. If you only have one regulatory body monitoring chemical safety, and that body gets captured by industry lobbyists, the public is entirely defenseless.
Oh, I see.
Redundancy ensures there is an alternative pathway for evidence to be heard. It preserves minority evidence that might be inconvenient to the primary actor.
But how does that solve the gridlock or the overlapping bureaucracy problem?
Because redundancy must be paired with an explicit accountability map. The danger of overlap is the diffusion of responsibility.
Yeah.
If three different agencies share a broad mandate for water quality, each one will assume the other is going to take the expensive, politically difficult action. Affected citizens get bounced from a state office to a federal office to a local zoning board and back again.
Oh my gosh, we'd love to help, but that's a municipal issue. We have all lived through that nightmare. Political leaders will eagerly take credit for any success, but the second there's a failure, they point to the overlap and claim it wasn't their jurisdiction.
Exactly. So to have the safety of redundancy without the paralysis of irresponsibility, you must have named primary and secondary duties. You need explicit public handoff rules.
Okay, so someone is always formally holding the bag.
Yes. If the primary agency fails to respond to a detected injury within a specified time frame, there must be an escalation protocol to a secondary actor. The accountability map ensures everyone knows exactly where the decision power lies and exactly who holds the remedial responsibility when things go wrong.
So you can have multiple safety nets, but someone still has to be legally designated as the person holding the net. That covers the integrated consequences side of the grammar. But who actually gets to decide what those duties are? Who gets to pull the levers of power when a consequence forces an action?
And this brings us to the second half, differentiate authority. This requires us to look deeply at the function authority legitimacy architecture, which begins with a seemingly simple question. Legitimate to do what?
Right, because we usually talk about institutional legitimacy as if it's this glowing universal aura. We ask, you know, is the Supreme Court legitimate or is the United Nations legitimate? But this framework argues that's a fundamentally flawed way of looking at power.
It is flawed because legitimacy isn't a blanket trait. It is inextricably tied to a specific function. The warrant for holding power changes depending on what you are trying to do.
So the source of the power matters.
Absolutely. Democratic election, scientific expertise, legal authorization, lived experiences all warrant entirely different functions. You cannot simply swap them out.
The research maps out these specific functions in detail. Let's walk through some of them because I feel like it clarifies so much about why our politics feel so broken right now. Let's start at the beginning of a problem. The first function is to detect injury. Who has the legitimate warrant to detect an injury?
The warrant for detection comes from measurement, observation, and situated knowledge. The people living next to the polluted river or the sensors placed in the water have the legitimacy to detect the harm.
Okay.
The proper consequence of that detection is that a signal must enter an assessment pathway.
Then you move to the next function, assess evidence.
Right. And the warrant for assessment does not come from winning an election. It comes from domain expertise, transparent methodologies, and plural review. Its proper consequence is providing a public account of confidence, uncertainty, and alternative scenarios. A scientific panel derives its legitimacy purely from its rigorous methods.
Then you have functions like representing affected parties, which gets its legitimacy from legal standing and accountable selection. Or the massive one, authorized collective action.
Yes. The authorization of collective action, passing a law, mandating a transition, banning a chemical, gets its warrant from constitutional, democratic, and legal mandates. A legislature gets its legitimacy to authorize action from the consent of the governed through elections, not from scientific expertise.
And there are others, right? Like resourcing, which is the lawful allocation of funds. Implementing, which demands operational competence and adherence to due process.
Reviewing and remedying, which requires independence and strict jurisdiction, like a court. And learning and redesigning, which requires institutional memory and constitutional authority.
When you break governance down into these distinct functions, you could immediately spot one of the most critical dangers identified in the manuscript. It's a phenomenon called authority leakage.
What's fascinating here is how often this happens without us even noticing. Authority leakage occurs when an actor takes their legitimate competence in one specific function and quietly converts it into unwarranted control over a completely different function.
I love this concept. Think about a brilliant executive chef at a high-end restaurant. That chef has absolute, unquestionable, legitimate authority over the menu. They understand flavor profiles, ingredient sourcing, cooking techniques better than anyone. But if that chef suddenly decides, because I am a certified genius at making a souffle, I am now going to do the restaurant's corporate taxes and renegotiate our commercial real estate lease. That is authority leakage.
That is a perfect illustration.
Competence in culinary arts does not transfer to competence in corporate tax law.
And in the realm of governance, this leakage is constantly happening, and it destroys institutional trust. It can be formal, like an administrative coordinating body suddenly issuing binding legal rules that go way beyond its original statute.
Oh, yeah.
Or it can be epistemic, where the data classifications used by an unelected assessment body quietly dictate what kinds of claims are even allowed to be heard by elected policymakers.
And the research highlights two massive recurring errors when it comes to authority leakage, specifically between science and politics, the technocratic error and the populist error.
Both of these are fatal to civilizational healing. Let's look at the technocratic era first. This is the assumption that if we just acquire better facts, better data, and better scientific modeling, it will somehow dissolve political disagreement. It assumes that expertise in the function of assessment automatically grants the authority to make political choices about collective ends.
This is the danger of the phrase, "the science tells us what to do." Science doesn't tell us what to value. Science can tell us that a transition to renewable energy is necessary to prevent catastrophic warming. But it cannot tell us who should bear the economic cost of that transition.
Exactly.
It can't decide whether a carbon tax or a cap-and-trade system is more socially just. It just tells us what is happening chemically and thermodynamically.
The facts underdetermine our collective ends. When scientists try to use their models to bypass democratic debate over values and distribution, they commit the technocratic error. They leak their assessment authority into authorization authority.
But the exact opposite is just as dangerous, the populist error.
Right. The populist error is the assumption that democratic elections grant politicians the right to dictate what the scientific evidence actually says.
Yeah.
It assumes that because you hold the legitimate mandate to authorize collective action, you also possess the authority to manufacture, distort, or suppress facts to suit your political convenience.
I mean, a politician winning a landslide election does not change the chemical composition of the atmosphere, period. You can pass a law declaring that sea levels aren't rising, but the water doesn't care about your legislation.
A politician mapping the atmosphere is just as absurd as a climatologist acting as a global emperor.
Exactly.
We have to keep these functions separated, but, and here is the incredible difficulty of this entire endeavor, they must remain connected. Assessment must inform authorization, and authorization must respond to assessment. So how do we prevent leakage if these domains have to constantly interact?
That brings us to a specific architectural design the author calls a reflexive boundary institution. We hear the phrase science-policy interface all the time in environmental news. But this research adds the word reflexive, which changes the entire game.
Boundary organization scholarship has existed for decades. It studies how institutions connect domains that operate with completely different languages, different timelines, and different standards of what constitutes truth, like science and politics. But the crucial insight here is that translation between these domains is always selective.
Meaning that when you summarize something, you are inherently making a choice about what matters.
Exactly. When you translate thousands of pages of complex probabilistic scientific knowledge into a 20-page summary for policymakers, you are exercising power. You are selecting which variables to highlight. You are choosing the time horizons. You are making decisions about how to represent deep uncertainty.
Right.
That translation process makes the knowledge usable for politicians, but it can also easily erase dissenting scientific views or hide the severe localized impacts of a problem behind global averages.
So the translation itself is an exercise of power. It dictates the boundaries of the debate before the politicians even sit down at the table.
The power of a boundary institution lies in what it makes consequential. A reflexive boundary institution is one that actively makes its own framing, its own selection processes, and its own power effects completely visible and open to revision.
So it's transparent about its own bias.
Yes. It doesn't just hand down a report from the mountaintop. It discloses who participated in the framing, whose questions structured the inquiry, and what remedies exist if a vital perspective was marginalized.
To make this concrete, the research proposes a rule called the boundary authority principle, which has two reciprocal clauses to act as a shield. The first clause is, authority to assess, synthesize, or translate knowledge does not thereby confer authority to determine collective ends.
That is the anti-technocracy safeguard. Assessors do not decide ends.
And the second clause, authority to determine collective ends does not thereby confer authority to determine what the evidence says.
The anti-politicization safeguard. Deciders do not alter evidence. It is an incredibly elegant separation. But theory is one thing. How does this actually survive contact with reality? The research provides a major global case study to examine this. The relationship between the IPCC and the UNFCCC.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. This is the biggest science policy interface on the planet.
It is a classic example of a principal boundary. The IPCC is the assessor. They assess the vast body of published scientific knowledge regarding climate change. They have author teams, exhaustive expert reviews, and incredibly strict procedures for distinguishing exactly how confident they are in any given finding.
Right.
Their formal structural mandate is to be policy relevant, but strictly not policy prescriptive.
They diagnose the illness, but they don't write the prescription. And then you have the UNFCCC and its Conference of the Parties, the COP meetings we hear about every year. That is a completely separate site. Its function is for negotiating commitments, authorizing political action, and organizing global finance. So based on the boundary authority principle, this should be a hard wall between the two, right? Scientists on one side of the glass, politicians on the other.
Actually, no. And this is a nuance the research strongly emphasizes. A hard wall would make the science politically irrelevant. The architecture advocates for managed permeability.
Managed permeability.
Governments actually participate heavily in the IPCC process. They don't just passively receive reports. They help scope the outlines of the reports so the answers will actually address the policy questions they are facing. They nominate authors. And most controversially, government representatives review and approve the final summaries for policymakers line by line in plenary sessions.
Wait, hold on. If government diplomats and politicians are sitting in a room approving a scientific summary line by line, isn't that the definition of the populist error? Aren't politicians messing with the science to protect their national industries?
It is a massive point of tension, and you're hitting on the exact vulnerability. That permeability can, and sometimes does, produce immense strategic pressure, resulting in watered-down consensus language. But the architecture holds because it is governed by traceable evidence rules.
Okay, how does that work?
A government representative can argue over a sentence in the draft, but their argument must be adjudicated based strictly on the underlying scientific literature. A politician cannot covertly manufacture a finding, nor can they delete a finding that is heavily supported by the underlying chapters.
So they can haggle over the phrasing, but they can't change the math.
Precisely. And this permeability serves a vital function. It builds political ownership. Because the politicians were in the room, because they helped scope the questions and fought over the summary, they cannot later claim they were ignorant of the findings. They own the science they approved.
The interaction works as long as the roles are specified. But as with all these massive systems, there is a catch.
The research points out that while this boundary restraint between the IPCC and the UNFCCC is procedurally strong, the interoperability is tragically weak.
Going back to our smoke detector analogy, the connection is there, but the sprinkler system isn't wired to it.
Exactly. An IPCC finding that global emissions must peak immediately to avoid catastrophic warming does not automatically trigger any binding political consequence at the UNFCCC.
Right. There's no automatic penalty.
There is no legal pathway where a scientific threshold crossing automatically forces a budget reallocation or a mandatory enforceable emissions cut among nations. The science can constrain the claims politicians are allowed to make in public, but it cannot authorize an adequate transition on its own.
Which opens up a huge objection that the author anticipates, the depoliticization objection. Some critics argue that these massive boundary institutions, these panels, forums, and stakeholder dialogues actually do harm by turning massive moral and political conflicts into boring technical disagreements. They run a crisis through a stakeholder consultation process and strip all the actual politics and urgency out of it.
It is a profoundly serious critique. If a boundary institution hands down a unified consensus report, it might completely erase morally relevant dissent. An economic model might optimize for the aggregate global economy, making a policy look like a massive success, while completely hiding the fact that a specific marginalized community is going to lose their land and livelihoods to pay for it.
So what does this all mean for a reflexive institution? How does it handle that?
A reflexive boundary institution must explicitly name unresolved normative conflict. It cannot pretend it doesn't exist. It has to separate empirical uncertainty, things we just don't know yet, from value disagreement, things we fundamentally disagree on morally.
Okay.
And when it hits a value disagreement, it must specify that this question cannot be solved by a spreadsheet. It needs to be thrown back into the political arena for a democratic fight. It should never claim to have solved a political problem with a technical summary.
Okay, so we've solved for the scientists and the global diplomats. But what about the average person? The people actually living in the houses that are too hot or trying to farm next to the degraded river? We have all these massive non-elected bodies wielding huge power regulators, scientific panels, central banks, independent auditors. We don't vote for them. So how on earth do we anchor these institutions back to real people and real democracy?
This leads us into two incredibly important concepts, democratic anchorage and causal scale subsidiarity. Let's tackle democratic anchorage first. As you said, modern complexity requires institutions that are not directly elected, but the research draws on governance network scholarship to argue that the legitimacy of these non-electoral bodies cannot just be reduced to performance.
They can't just say, well, the economy is growing, so we are legitimate.
Exactly. They need democratic anchorage, but that anchorage has to be custom fitted to their specific function and the type of risk they pose to the public. One size does not fit all.
Break that down for me. What does anchorage look like for different functions?
Well, for a scientific panel, democratic anchorage doesn't mean electing the scientists. It means strict methodological transparency, plural peer review, and public disclosure of the limits of their models. They are anchored by the transparency of their process.
Makes sense.
But for a coercive regulator, say, an environmental agency that can shut down a factory anchorage means they must operate strictly under legislative law, they must provide rigorous due process, and their decisions must be subject to judicial review by courts.
And if an institution is allocating public funds?
It needs a lawful mandate, absolute transparency in its accounting, strict conflict of interest rules, and a direct route for public appeal if a community is unjustly denied funding.
The text dives into a really fascinating real-world case study here regarding direct citizen participation. We hear a lot about mini-publics and citizens' assemblies these days. The idea of putting randomly selected citizens in a room to deliberate on complex issues. But often, it feels like a gimmick. The research looks at Ostbelgium, the German-speaking community of Belgium, to show how to do this right.
The Ostbelgian model is a masterclass in democratic anchorage through institutional coupling. In 2019, their parliament didn't just hold a weekend workshop. They created a permanent citizens' dialogue embedded in law.
Permanent. That changes the dynamic completely.
It changes everything. They created a rotating citizens' council that helps select the topics and organize temporary, randomly selected citizens' assemblies. These assemblies spend time learning, deliberating, and formulating policy recommendations. But here is the critical architectural genius. The elected parliament and the government retain their legal and representative authority.
So the citizens don't replace the politicians.
Right. The citizens' assembly does not replace the legislature. However, the elected bodies are legally required to respond to the assembly's recommendations through specified public procedures.
So they couple the raw deliberation of citizens directly to the formal representation of politicians.
Exactly. The research emphasizes why this specific mechanism matters. It creates institutional memory and forces accountability. Agenda formation, temporary deliberation, representative response, giving public reasons for accepting or rejecting ideas, and tracking implementation, it all forms a continuous, legally mandated chain.
This directly prevents a toxic practice the author calls legitimacy laundering. I think everyone who has ever interacted with local government has seen this. A city council wants to push through a highly controversial zoning change, so they convene a community stakeholder panel, they take a bunch of photos, they publish a glossy PDF report with quotes from citizens, and then they completely ignore the panel's actual advice,
yeah,
passing the policy they wanted all along while claiming the policy has public consent.
That is the textbook definition of legitimacy laundering. The mere existence of a public forum is falsely presented as public consent, while the actual agenda setting and decision making remain hidden in the back rooms. In Ostbelgien, the design differentiates the capacity to organize citizen deliberation from the authority to enact law. But it makes dismissing the citizens' advice highly visible and politically costly. Elected officials have to stand up in public on the record and give substantive reasons for why they are rejecting the citizens' recommendations.
But to be fair, the author's realistic about this, right? Even in Ostbelgien, the interoperability is still partial. The elected bodies retain the ultimate discretion to say no. And it works there partly because Ostbelgien is a small, relatively consensual political culture. It's not a silver bullet that you can just drop into a massive, highly polarized nation and expect miracles.
The research is very clear on that limitation. The Ostbelgien case identifies a structural mechanism worth testing permanent coupling and mandatory response, but it doesn't guarantee it will survive intense adversarial conditions without further adaptation.
Okay, I want to pivot to the other side of this anchorage equation. Subsidiarity. Usually when I hear the word subsidiarity, I think of the classic political conservative argument. Let the locals decide. Keep the power as close to the ground and as close to the affected people as humanly possible. But the author argues this knee-jerk localism can actually cause massive civilizational problems.
Subsidiarity is a vital, irreplaceable principle. But the text offers a very specific civilizational healing update to it. It argues that we must scale authority to the causal process, not to the geographic map.
Scale authority to the causation. What does that actually mean in practice?
It means you have to look at the injury and ask, which unit of governance can actually perceive, reach, and alter the systemic process that is producing this harm? If an upstream municipality is dumping toxic industrial waste into a river, destroying the drinking water and the economy of a downstream municipality, leaving the regulatory decision to the upstream local authority is disastrous.
Oh, because they're not the ones feeling the pain.
Exactly. The cause of the harm travels, the burden of the harm travels, therefore the authority to regulate it must travel.
The text outlines five specific theoretical reasons why authority absolutely must escalate beyond the local level. Let's walk through them.
First, externalities. As we just discussed with the river, if local action displaces severe burdens onto others or cannot bind actors who are causing the problem from afar, authority must escalate to encompass all parties.
Right.
Second, rights. We need common, non-negotiable floors because local majorities often dominate, exclude, or oppress local minorities. You need a higher authority to protect those baselines.
Third is unequal capacity. This is a huge one, especially when we talk about federal governments pushing responsibilities down to states or cities. Devolution without funding.
Exactly. A national government transferring the responsibility for complex healthcare management or climate adaptation to local communities without transferring any revenue, tax authority, or technical expertise is not subsidiarity. It is abandonment.
Oh, yeah.
Escalation, in this case, might not mean central command, but it means higher level implementation support, shared financing, or capacity building.
Fourth is displaced burdens. We need representation for people across borders or even future generations who are harmed by today's hyper-local economic decisions. And fifth, the most daunting one, cross-scale causes.
Yes. This is when the sheer scale of the causal system driving the injury completely exceeds local reach. And the research provides a sobering, tragic case study to illustrate this. The governance of the Great Barrier Reef in Australia.
This is the case study that completely bursts the bubble of romanticizing local, polycentric governance. We love the idea of local communities coming together to manage their resources, but break down what is actually happening with the reef.
On paper, the Great Barrier Reef has an incredibly dense, sophisticated, well-funded, polycentric governance structure.
Yeah.
You have the Commonwealth of Australia and the Queensland state governments working together. You have the dedicated Marine Park Authority. Crucially, Indigenous traditional owners are deeply involved in co-management. You have world-class scientific monitoring bodies, UNESCO oversight, local municipal governments, tourism industry boards, and conservation NGOs. They have integrated outlook reports, zoning laws, water quality runoff targets for local sugarcane farmers, and starfish culling programs. It looks like an absolute masterpiece of multi-level inclusive governance.
They have all the centers, they have the monitoring, they have the local action, they have the Indigenous knowledge. It is the polycentric dream.
But despite all of that brilliant local management, the ecosystem is collapsing. The 2024 Outlook report clearly identifies climate change as the greatest long-term threat to the reef. Massive marine heat waves driven by global carbon emissions are causing unprecedented coral bleaching. Cyclones are intensifying.
It's just devastating.
And here's the tragic structural mismatch. Local marine institutions, no matter how inclusive, well-funded, or competent they are, cannot control global carbon emissions.
There's a massive causal mismatch between the scale of the governance and the scale of the injury.
Exactly. The global climate forcing is completely overwhelming their competent local management. So the theoretical finding here is that an institutional ecology must be evaluated against the causal system it is trying to manage, not just the competence of its bounded parts.
Having perfect local rules doesn't save you from a global crisis.
Right. Having rich monitoring, local inclusion, and perfect water quality targets means absolutely nothing if you have zero influence over the dominant thermodynamic drivers destroying your ecosystem. That is a state of epistemic reflexivity. They know exactly why they are dying without adequate transformational capacity to stop it.
So if we follow this logic to its conclusion, and we keep escalating problems to higher and higher levels to match the massive scale of these causes, who governs those higher level coordinators.
Mm-hmm.
If we create a massive global platform to coordinate all these fragmented pieces, how do we stop that platform from becoming the very dictator we were trying to avoid in the beginning?
You've just articulated what the framework calls the metagovernance paradox.
The metagovernance paradox. Let's dig into this. What exactly is metagovernance?
Metagovernance simply means the governance of governance. In any decentralized polycentric system, Someone eventually has to do the coordinating work. Someone has to convene the meetings, set the agendas, define who is allowed to be a member of the network, create the shared data standards, and allocate the centralized funding.
It sounds like administrative housekeeping. Just the boring logistics of keeping the network running.
It looks administrative, but the research argues forcefully that these are actually constitutional functions because they completely distribute the opportunities and constraints of the entire system. Think about it. The person who sets the agenda decides which problems even receive collective attention and which are ignored.
The funding conditions privilege certain interventions and starve others.
Exactly. The data standards determine what becomes visible and comparable and what is structurally erased.
So a coordinator might not have the power to issue a direct coercive command, but they have the structural power to dictate what is even possible for the network to do.
Yes, and this leads to the paradox. The institutions required to coordinate a polycentric system often become massive centers of structural power themselves. The platform operator, the primary funder, the lead agency, they become a new, unchallengeable monocenter.
Oh, wow.
The text points out that you can have a highly fragmented local system that looks beautifully decentralized, but is actually completely micromanaged by a central metagovernor who controls the purse strings.
So how do we solve that? We need coordination, but the coordinators inevitably become tyrants.
The solution proposed is to distribute the coordination functions themselves. You do not try to find one perfect, neutral, angelic metagovernor. You allocate the powers by distinct warrant, just as we discussed with the functions earlier.
Give me a concrete example of how you disaggregate metagovernance.
For instance, a democratically elected legislature establishes the broad goals and the rights frameworks. An independent scientific body evaluates the evidence of whether those goals are being met. A joint administrative board coordinates the actual implementation among agencies.
A separate multilateral fund enables the lower capacity actors to participate.
And an independent court hears challenges if any of those bodies overstep. You disaggregate the metagovernance.
But wait, if you distribute it that much, aren't we back to the diffusion of responsibility?
That is the tightrope. You don't distribute responsibility so thinly that it disappears into the ether. Each of those metagovernance functions still needs a named holder, explicit handoffs between them, and a clear route of public appeal.
Got it. Now, there's another way we often try to coordinate decentralized systems, and it's very popular right now. It's called experimentalist governance. The idea is that the center doesn't dictate everything. We let local areas experiment with different policies, we see what works, and we learn together as a network. It sounds great, but how do we allow local areas to experiment without letting them violate basic rights in the name of learning?
That is a crucial vulnerability, and the author addresses it by proposing constitutionally bounded experimentalism. Experimentalist governance is incredibly appealing because it acknowledges that the center doesn't and can't know everything in advance.
Right.
You set broad goals, you let local units figure out the context-specific implementation, they report back their results, and the whole network revises the goals based on that learning.
It sounds like the scientific method applied directly to public policy.
It does. But the research warns that this formal recursion can very easily become an empty ritual. You can end up with endless cycles of reporting that never actually change practice. Or, much worse, local variations just become a convenient cover to externalize harm onto marginalized groups.
That's terrifying.
The text is adamant on this point. Populations bearing the risks of institutional learning remain political subjects with rights. They are not experimental material.
Yes. You cannot just treat citizens like lab rats to see if a deregulated housing policy or a new healthcare algorithm works.
Therefore, decentralized experimentation must happen within strict constitutional bounds. It must happen within non-negotiable rights floors that absolutely cannot be suspended for the sake of innovation or learning.
Right.
Furthermore, there must be legal standing for those bearing the risks to object. There must be independent monitoring, material support for the implementers so they aren't set up to fail, and most importantly, strict stopping rules. If an experiment is demonstrably failing and hurting people, there must be an authoritative mechanism to halt it immediately.
To illustrate where this goes wrong, the text provides a massive case study on the European Union Water Framework Directive.
Mm?
This is one of the most ambitious environmental policies in the world meant to clean up Europe's rivers.
Yes. It is considered a mature textbook example of experimentalist architecture. It organizes water policy naturally around river basins rather than political borders. It sets common objectives for water quality. It uses six-year management cycles, where local basin authorities monitor the water, consult with the public, draft river basin management plans, and peer review each other across member states. It looks flawless on paper.
But you know there's a but coming.
But the research cites official reporting from 2025 showing a catastrophic failure in outcomes. Only about 39.5% of reported surface water bodies were in good ecological status. Decades of this perfect experimentalist process, and the rivers are still polluted.
Why?
Because while the system has incredible connectivity and endless monitoring, its interoperability with the actual causal drivers of the pollution is fundamentally weak.
Meaning, the local basin authority writes a brilliant, data-rich report saying their river is being choked by agricultural fertilizer runoff. But that report has no legal power to actually force a change in agricultural policy.
Exactly. The basin authority detects the injury perfectly, but the evidence of poor water status lacks a direct, leveratable pathway into national agricultural subsidy policy or infrastructure investment or cross-border enforcement.
Oh, wow.
The agricultural lobby at the national level can simply block the necessary fertilizer regulations, rendering the basin-level monitoring completely impotent. The feedback lacks leverage.
So they are just learning how badly they are failing, over and over again, in six-year cycles.
If we connect this to the overarching theory, feedback isn't reflexivity unless an authorized actor is structurally forced to change their practice. You can have endless cycles of monitoring, consultation, and plan drafting. But if the report just goes into a drawer because a powerful lobby blocks it, you haven't learned anything.
You have merely documented your own structural failure.
Yes.
That is a devastating critique of how a massive amount of modern policy operates. We mistake the generation of reports for actual action. Now, we've talked a lot about human coordinators, politicians, basin authorities, scientific panels, but I want to pivot to something entirely different. Because the research dives into a hidden type of central authority that is emerging right now, and it threatens to override everything we've just built.
Yes. We must examine artificial intelligence, not just as a tool, but as a hidden monocenter of power.
This part of the text feels incredibly pressing. We tend to think of AI as a calculator or a search engine, but Saley frames it as an infrastructural dependency. To understand this, break down the difference between visible centralization and infrastructural centralization.
Visible centralization is the traditional threat we are trained to recognize and fear. A political dictator, a single draconian law, a central planning office that dictates quotas. It places formal legal decision-making authority in one obvious office.
Right. You can point to it.
You can read it in legal code, and you can challenge it through ordinary constitutional routes, like an election or a Supreme Court.
It's power out in the open.
Exactly. But infrastructural centralization is insidious because it leaves formal authority completely distributed. On paper, you might have five different government ministries, a network of independent courts, and a dozen scientific panels. They look like a beautiful, pluralistic, highly differentiated, polycentric network.
Okay, so what's the problem?
But if all of those independent agencies rely on the exact same AI foundational model, the exact same cloud computing infrastructure, and the exact same data brokers to process their information, they are only formally independent. Substantively, operationally, they are captured by a common, invisible technical center.
Think about this in your own life. Let's say you apply for a small business loan in your local bank and get denied. So you appeal to a state grant program and they deny you. But you go to a federal program and they deny you too.
Yeah.
You think you've been evaluated by three independent institutions. But if all three of them bought their risk assessment AI from the exact same Silicon Valley vendor, you weren't evaluated three times. You were evaluated once by one algorithm wearing three different institutional masks. They all share the same brain.
Precisely. If that underlying AI model has a built-in bias regarding certain zip codes or a specific opaque way it categorizes financial risk, all those independent agencies are going to make the exact same biased decision. And worse, they will claim they arrived at it independently.
This is what the text calls infrastructural monocentricity.
It is a dependence that is deeply consequential, entirely opaque to the public, and extremely hard to exit once an institution is locked into the software ecosystem. The provider of that model quietly determines the update cycles, the security architecture, the permissible uses, and the practical cost of switching to a different worldview.
And the research issues a massive warning here regarding accountability. because governments are rapidly adopting AI for everything from screening welfare applicants to predicting crime hotspots to optimizing power grids.
The author is unequivocal on this point. AI systems can synthesize vast amounts of data, they can translate across languages, they can explore complex scenarios, but they fundamentally cannot bear democratic responsibility.
Right, you can't put a model on trial.
They cannot possess legal standing, they cannot authorize collective ends, and they cannot provide a remedy when someone is harmed.
The algorithm recommended it is not a legal or moral excuse for a government agency.
It is an illegitimate handoff of authority. Human institutions remain entirely, inescapably accountable for the adoption of the system and the consequences it produces. Therefore, the research argues that a procurement contract for an AI system is not just an IT decision, it actually has profound constitutional effects. It shapes what the agency is functionally capable of knowing, seeing, and doing.
The text mentions a specific contemporary case study regarding how the world is trying to govern this. The UN General Assembly resolution from 2025 establishing a scientific panel on AI.
Yes, Resolution 79325. It established an independent international scientific panel on AI alongside a global dialogue framework. On its face, the architecture separates the scientific assessment of AI from the intergovernmental political dialogue about it, which perfectly aligns with the boundary authority principle we discussed earlier.
But the research doesn't just assume this panel will save us, right? It poses some critical structural questions.
Exactly. Because the institution is too new to judge by its outcomes, the text applies its analytical framework to the architecture itself. Who exactly is defining the evidence standards for this new panel? How are marginalized communities, who often bear the brunt of algorithmic bias, represented in the assessment?
What specific authority do their reports explicitly lack?
And most profoundly, does creating a common global knowledge infrastructure for AI actually pluralize our understanding of the technology, or does it just quietly establish a single global epistemic center that gets to decide what is true about AI for the rest of the world?
It's the ultimate metagovernance paradox applied to the ultimate metagovernance tool. If we rely on a centralized AI to coordinate our understanding of the world, whoever coordinates the AI rules the world. So this all feels quite heavy. We have institutions that lack leverage. We have the threat of AI monocenters. We have perfectly designed systems that still fail. If our feedback loops are just endless reports with no legal teeth, what is the ultimate safety valve? How do we break out of a broken architecture?
This brings us to the final and perhaps the deepest concept in the entire manuscript: constitutional reflexivity.
Constitutional reflexivity. We need to distinguish this from ordinary learning. Unpack the difference between ordinary policy learning and constitutional learning.
Ordinary policy learning occurs when you change a rule within the existing accepted allocation of authority. For example, a city's transportation department notices a high number of accidents at a specific intersection. So, using their existing authority, they lower the speed limit or install a stoplight. They gathered evidence, they learned, and they adapted, all within their given powers.
Simple cause and effect. The system worked.
But constitutional learning is required when you have to change the actual relationships of power. When a system persistently structurally fails, like the EU Water Directive we discussed, where decades of reports don't stop the agricultural pollution, the failure isn't because we have the wrong speed limit on fertilizer.
Oh, I see.
The failure is produced by the institutional relationships themselves. The responsibility is structurally unowned, or one agency is captured by a lobby, or the environmental evidence isn't legally allowed to enter the national budget discussion.
So constitutional reflexivity means having a recognized legal mechanism to redesign the jurisdiction, to change the flow of finance, or to completely rewrite the review process itself. It's rewriting the rules of the game when the current game is consistently producing terrible outcomes.
Exactly. You are changing who has the power to do what. And importantly, the research doesn't just leave us with failures to illustrate this. It offers a massive historic success story to prove that constitutional reflexivity is possible on a global scale.
Yes. The Montreal Protocol. The international treaty that literally saved the ozone layer. I love this example because it proves we actually can get things right when the architecture is sound.
It is a profound, enduring example of civilizational healing. The Montreal Protocol successfully healed the ozone layer by phasing out the global use of chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs. But the critical question is, why did it work so spectacularly when our climate change treaties struggle so much? The text explains that the protocol succeeded because it heavily differentiated its functions and it possessed constitutional reflexivity.
Walk us through the mechanisms. How did it actually work?
First, the assessment of the atmospheric science and the available replacement technologies was kept strictly separate from the political authorization by the parties to the treaty. They didn't commit the technocratic or populist errors.
But the real structural genius, the thing that made the treaty actually function in the real world, was the multilateral fund.
Yes. The architects of the regime didn't just point to the developing nations and say, hey, you need to transition away from these cheap CFC chemicals for the good of the planet. Good luck. They recognized that this transition represented an unequal burden. A developing nation trying to build its refrigeration industry couldn't just magically afford the more expensive alternative chemicals.
So they built a financial mechanism directly into the treaty.
They created a multilateral fund that structurally financed the transition for developing countries, the Article 5 countries. And it didn't just give them loans. The fund, capitalized by the developed nations based on their UN assessment scale, agreed to pay the incremental costs of the transition.
So if a developing nation needed to retool an entire aerosol factory line to use a safe chemical instead of a CFC, the fund paid for that retooling.
Precisely. It converted the abstract concept of differentiated responsibility into actual material capacity to act. Yeah. It wasn't just a rule on a piece of paper, it was a checkbook connected to the rule.
It made the political authorization completely interoperable with the resourcing and the implementation.
And crucially, the treaty itself was adaptive. It had procedures to adjust and accelerate the phase-out schedules as new, scarier scientific assessments came in over the years. The architecture enabled immediate action, and it possessed the constitutional capacity to correct its own course.
The author distills this entire philosophy of governance into a reflexive corollary, which serves as a kind of golden rule for institutional design.
The golden rule is stated as this. The institutions that coordinate others must remain inside the system of coordination, contestation, and correction, not above it.
No one is above the law, not even the people writing the data standards or operating the AI platform.
No one is exempt from accountability. If a meta-governor controls the evaluation metrics for a network, there must be an independent, external route to evaluate that meta-governor. If a system manages shared infrastructure, the capacity for participants to exit that infrastructure must be constitutionally protected, otherwise it becomes a prison.
Here is where it gets really powerful. When you strip away all the matrices, the quadrants, and the academic terminology, this entire manuscript boils down to one simple operational requirement. Just one.
Capacity to act plus capacity to correct.
Capacity to act plus capacity to correct. If you only have the capacity to act without the capacity to correct, you get monocentric domination. You get a tyrant who makes terrible, destructive mistakes and structurally cannot be stopped.
And if you only have the capacity to correct, if you only have monitors and auditors, you get what the author calls ritual reflexivity.
Right.
Endless public consultations, endless peer-reviewed reports, endless veto points, but nothing ever actually gets done while the river dies and the planet burns.
It is such a powerful, clarifying synthesis.
Yeah.
We have covered an immense amount of ground today. We've navigated the coordination-domination dilemma, where trying to fix fragmentation often creates tyranny. We've learned that we don't have to choose between a chaotic world where nothing gets done mm-hmm. and a dystopian world where one actor controls everything.
We have a viable third option, a polycentric constitutional ecology. By integrating consequences, ensuring that detecting a harm actually triggers an actionable, resourced response, and by differentiating authority, ensuring that people only wield the specific power they actually have a warrant for, we can build systems that actually heal.
And we learned that our feedback loops need actual, leverageable teeth. A monitoring report isn't a solution unless it can force an authorized actor to change their behavior.
This deep dive into Sahili's research isn't just an abstract exercise in global political science. If we connect this to the bigger picture, to you listening right now, this architecture applies to your daily life. Think about the institutions you interact with every single day, your company's HR department, your local city council zoning board, the healthcare network you rely on, the digital platforms that shape what news you see.
The research leaves us with a final, profound provocation that I want to adapt for you to think about as you navigate your week. Look at the systems governing your life. If they repeatedly produce outcomes that contradict their stated purpose, if the health system makes you sicker, if the environmental agency watches the river die, if the tech platform makes you less connected,
And if no one, including you, has the standing, the legal pathway, or the power to trigger a review of the rules themselves, then your institutions are only capable of learning within the boundaries of their own persistent failure.
So the fundamental question you have to ask is this: who in your world has the actual power to change the relationships? Because until those underlying relationships change, the injuries will continue and the system will keep spinning in place. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.